Welcome to CMDA's podcast, where we discuss common medical problems and situations common to long-term care. Our goal is to have an interdepartmental approach. This is not intended to guide treatment and is not a replacement for current guidelines or treatments. Now, please welcome our hosts, Dr. Singh Pallett and Allison Villegas, where they were going to discuss DVTs. Consider subscribing to CMDA, where our goal is to provide support and education for staff in all areas of long-term care.
Well, thanks for the introduction, Galen. And I'm happy to be here with Allison also. And I'm so glad to have a chance to talk about my case. This is one of my patients that I took care of last summer, and I'll just go right into it. This is an 85-year-old woman who I had just seen 3 days ago for her regulatory visit. And at that time, she was seen for just routine things, dyspepsia, looked at her hypokalemia treatment, her progress in restorative therapy and dementia, and there were no acute issues at the time. And so one evening, the nurse called because the patient was complaining of pain. And the nurse found that her left leg was completely swollen and firm all the way from the ankle up to the knees. Left leg was warm to touch and very painful. She rated it an 8 out of 10, and it was red and erythematous. The nurse was very quick on her toes, and she grabbed a Doppler to confirm the pulses in the dorsalis pedis. And at that time, all of her vitals were stable, including her pulse ox, which was 94% on room air. And the patient with her dementia was unable to give a history, and her daughter, her power of attorney, could not be reached right away. And so, things being on call, this was almost 11 p.m., I was getting ready for bed, and I was called as the physician, and my first reaction was, this could be a DVT. Let's send her to the emergency department. This needs to be evaluated. So I gave the order, and she did go to the nearest emergency department. There, she was evaluated. She had some labs checked, and the ER physician agreed that this could be a DVT, but the ultrasound technician had already gone home for the night. So they went ahead and started treatment, empiric treatment with enoxaparin. She was given 60 milligrams sub-Q to 12 hours, and recommendations were made for her to get an ultrasound the next day at 7 a.m. in the morning by coming through the outpatient radiology department. And luckily, the first dose of enoxaparin was given in the ER. So the next day, 7 in the morning, she showed up at the radiology department. She had orders from the ER physician and did have the ultrasound performed. The results were a non-occlusive thrombus to the common femoral, femoral, and popliteal veins. She had an occlusive thrombus to the peroneal vein in the left legs. And so orders were given by myself to continue with her anticoagulation. And at that time, we chose to start rivaroxaban orally. 3 days later, I did have a chance to follow up with her. She was doing much better. She was having pain in her left leg, but it was well managed with just low doses of tramadol and acetaminophen, and she found that elevating her leg was very helpful. When I reviewed her history a little further and went into the past record, it turned out that she actually did have a long history of recurrent DVTs, go figure. And she had been taking long-term anticoagulation for many years. She had declined a previous workup for secondary causes of recurrent DVTs. And just 1 year prior to me meeting her, her physician and her family at that time had decided that since she hadn't had a DVT for many years, and because her health was declining, that they were going to stop anticoagulation at that time. And so by the time I met her, she had been off of any anticoagulation for about a year. And to this day, she seems to be doing very well, and she remains on her rivaroxaban. But what do you guys think? Have you seen patients like this?
Yeah, I think the tricky part about that case is that it occurred when you're on call, and kind of knowing the limitations that are available when we take calls at 11 o'clock at night, you know, how might your workup have changed if you had taken the call during the day?
Sure. That's, you know, isn't that what happens? It always happens at the most inconvenient time when you have to make a quick decision. Yeah. So for this particular facility, I wasn't confident that we could get a diagnostic test quickly. And so I thought an emergency department should be our best bet. I didn't know that the emergency department also didn't have ultrasound in the evenings. So that was a surprise to me. So I think it's really important to know our local resources and understand capacity for doing tests like an ultrasound. I also had considered empiric treatment, but wasn't sure if we had Lovenox or Xarelto in the facility to start that night. And again, I figured that the emergency department probably had more resources to start a quick treatment, as well as make sure that her kidney and liver function were adequate to start treatment and making sure that her HNH was adequate too. So I made the decision to send her to the emergency room. Don't know if you would have too. And then she came right back, of course, with the treatment that she had.
Yeah, I think it is tricky because I know in a lot of my nursing homes that when I order, you know, even if you order it stat, which they tell you they can't do them stat, but the Doppler ultrasound, you're looking at best a 1 or 2 day turnaround, at worst 3 or 4. And so I think, you know, using the emergency room as a resource for a quicker workup is certainly something I have used in the past.
And I think that, go ahead, Galen, sorry.
Do you think there's a downside to starting enoxaparin empirically while you're waiting for a Doppler to be done? Say you're ordering it on a Saturday as an on-call and then order a Doppler and start enoxaparin.
Yeah, I think...
With the understanding that they'll call back if the patient worsens.
Right. Yeah, and that's definitely the key, is someone keeping an eye on the person and is appropriate follow-up being made. And I think for the right patient, someone who can potentially have a greater benefit to starting empiric treatment of anticoag compared to the risk of course, bleeding, empiric treatment, to put them on some treatment before we get a diagnostic test, it does make sense. And for the right person, it can be more helpful than harmful.
And I have to say, Singh, that was one of the things that I really liked about this case, is because, to be honest, I would have never thought of empirically treating a DVT, but even the ER does it, right? Like, they started the enoxaparin before they knew. And I think that that's really interesting. If you are looking at the risk and benefit profile of empiric treatment and knowing the half-life of some of the, especially the injectables or the low molecular weight heparin, like, that's going to be out of the system quickly, as opposed to starting something oral. And then once you have the firm diagnosis, switching to an oral. That was one of the take homes for me, is I guess, honestly, I had never considered empiric treatment for a DVT. Sure. So I like having that idea in my tool belt, to be honest.
Sure.
I think if you weigh the risk versus benefit, the benefit of treating with something like enoxaparin, now probably the Xarelto and some of the DOACs would have a much higher risk associated, but the risk of enoxaparin versus, or the benefit of enoxaparin versus the risk associated, is probably going to outweigh significantly. Because if you look at how we treat fractures and things like that, it's used very prevalently.
And I think, in the conversion to something like rivaroxaban, if you want to go to an oral, it's very easy. Once you start it, it's not like you're committed to the injectables.
Sure. And I think that the injectable low molecular weight heparins and the DOACs tend to have a shorter half-life compared to, say, something like warfarin. And so that has given us more leeway in terms of feeling comfortable starting empiric treatment for people who might have to wait for a Doppler to be performed.
And then what would you do differently if it was a more proximal DVT? Would that change your treatment plan?
Yes, I had to review this. When someone has a lower extremity DVT, if it's below the knee and it's an acute DVT, and it's not highly symptomatic, let's say, many of them don't become larger, they don't extend or become dangerous for the patient. And so specifically something like that's localized just to the peroneal vein. But if it does involve the popliteal vein or something more proximal, that's when it does become prudent to treat. And so what happens is that if someone has a proximal DVT, we can treat her like we did for this patient because hers involved her femoral veins and her popliteal veins. And we would get them on anticoagulation as soon as possible. But if she just had an isolated blood clot in the lower leg, the peroneal vein, let's say, because they don't necessarily progress or travel and become dangerous, it would be possible to consider not treating her at that time and repeating the ultrasound in 2 weeks to see if there's been any extension or to see if it's still there and see and make a judgment call at that time whether to commit her to anticoagulation. And that's something that I think in just the last few years has become a different decision point in our treatment of DVTs. And so it's important to know some anatomy for the leg, which I had to review, and to understand what the risk would be if it's simply a distal DVT.
And even because hers was non-occlusive in the more proximal veins, but it was occlusive in the more distal one. But even that, just the presence of even a non-occlusive would warrant the rapid treatment.
Yes, good point. Yep. And for this particular patient, she was clearly symptomatic. Her whole leg was swollen and painful, and it did seem important to get some kind of treatment on board.
And this is kind of a loaded question because she has a very unique history, but we always talk about, you know, how long do you do anticoagulation, especially for an initial or recurrent? And I think we all know some of the standard guidelines for that, but for this particular patient, given her history, did you have that conversation with the family on how long to continue treating with this DVT?
Yes, but it's an ongoing conversation.
Yeah.
So I agree with you, Allison. I feel like I know the standard treatments. If it's someone who has, say, a provoked DVT because of a recent surgery, then anticoagulation would be indicated for 3 months minimum, sometimes a little longer if someone appears to have a high risk. If there's no clear reason for it, we would be looking at more of a long-term situation. Perhaps some of the studies, I think, even say just 5 years. And after 6 years, we're actually not sure what the guidance is. And for her, because of her history of recurrent DVTs, and then this one that popped up a year after her last treatment, our conversation centered around how we would like to keep her on anticoagulation for the rest of her life, as long as it's tolerated. And that becomes a little unclear too. This is an older woman who is quite frail, and she is the exact kind of person where if there's gonna be a side effect of an anticoagulation, she's gonna get it. And so that becomes a little unclear as to when someone doesn't tolerate anticoagulation. But I can say that the last time she had been treated, she was being treated with warfarin. She'd been on anticoagulation for many years. And now with the newer direct oral anticoagulants that are a little more simple to administer and don't require the therapeutic monitoring, maybe, you know, her tolerance for the medication will be a little higher or a little longer.
That was going to be my very next question, is what was she on before? Because I once had an interesting patient who absolutely refused warfarin and kept clotting on rivaroxaban. And so do you switch them to another one? I mean, the risk profile, is it any different switching from one DOAC to another? And so it is always, always an ongoing conversation with the patient and families.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that when we say lifelong anticoagulation, in patients that we're taking care of in our long-term care facilities, it's always qualified by the words, you know, as tolerated.
Right. So what would you say would be your take-home pearls from this case or from this experience?
Sure, yeah. And what seemed like just a routine call, I think I learned a lot from it. One thing is to make sure that I and my nurses, the nurses that I work with in the facilities, know what to look for to suspect a DVT. And that can be part of our training. It can be some part of our bedside training or formal training for nursing aides, even. You know, if someone has a one leg that's very swollen and painful, we need to know right away. And that's important for all the staff to be aware of. I also learned that I have to be aware of the capacity for treatment in any particular community. If this person is going to the emergency room or not, I need to know both what this community is capable of for diagnostic tests, as well as potential empiric treatment, what kind of monitoring is available after that, as well as what can the local emergency room do. For instance, in this case, if I had known that ultrasound was only available during business hours, of course, I wouldn't have sent her that late at the in the nighttime to the emergency department. You know, we wouldn't have needed that transfer.
And also, I guess, knowing what's in their emergency kit, because if you knew that the ER couldn't do the ultrasound, would you have started empiric treatment in-house knowing what was in their e-kit?
Right. And at that time, I had assumed that they didn't have anticoagulation, but later I found out that they did. They had enoxaparin and rivaroxaban available in the e-kit. So that would have saved us a step. And I think it depends on the pharmacy, if I'm not mistaken, you know, for what in each facility's emergency kit.
And what they've already used and haven't refilled.
Yes. That's a great idea.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you. Galen, did you have any further questions?
No, I do have one comment on keeping in mind on patients who've had recurrent DVTs, that I know some of them decline workup and there isn't always a reason to do a workup, but it does become important for other family members if somebody's had recurrences that those are genetic. And so it may save somebody else a problem down the road if that was tested.
That's a good point.
That's a good point.
Yeah. And some people would be willing to do it if they knew it would help the family members.
That's true.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for going through my case with me.
Yeah. Thank you, Singh. Thanks, Galen.
Thank you.